So we're currently in the session post-break for a session called Adaptation of Crops to Climate Change. Please come in. And before the break, we heard the way this set of papers is being organized. We heard a little bit about, or we heard in some presentations about what are some of the major constraints in terms of a changing environment. Do we as agronomists, plant breeders, geneticists, physiologists need to be thinking about and worrying about in terms of what types of traits are important from the standpoint of thinking about adaptation? And so we heard a couple of different perspectives from the standpoint of atmospheric gases and changing atmospheric conditions. We also heard about water and the importance of water and some key considerations from the standpoint of how do we develop crops that are better adapted to low water conditions, particularly as it relates to conserving water resources early in the season so that they can be used later. And then the third talk of the first session was about, now that we have a sense of understanding about what some of the key constraints might be, where are we going to go from the standpoint of dealing with these in different crops? And we heard about maize was the first example, and efforts of Cimit to breed for maize with adaptation to high temperatures. And oftentimes you hear about the concepts of how do I develop my crop that has adaptations to the particular constraint of issue. Dr. Persona brought up the issue of it's not just genetics. There's also management that goes into the system as well. And sometimes that might be related to the fact of, you know, maybe changing the planting date, trying to figure out the right season and the right conditions and the right plant density and population. In some cases, it also involves changing how the crop is adapted to the environment so that you can indirectly select for improved stress tolerance. And that's the topic that we're going to be hearing about today in this next talk. It's winter hardy barley as a strategy for dealing with drought, changing from a summer season to a winter season type of cropping system. So our next speaker is Dr. Pat Hayes from Oregon State University.
Well, thank you, Mitch, and thanks to the symposium organizers. Really a pleasure to be here this morning and to see some familiar faces out in the audience. I'd like to talk to you about sort of shifting gears a bit for a crop that you may be familiar with, barley, and moving it into a different season of production and thus perhaps dodging a bullet, which would be drought by moving towards a different alternative production season. First, I'd like to acknowledge the framework within which we're doing this research. It's really thanks to the Tritici CAP, and this CAP project unites virtually all the wheat and barley breeding programs in the U.S. Under a research umbrella funded by USDA NIFA. I'm at Oregon State University, and if you'd like to learn more about what we do maintain a website called Barley World, and I'll take this moment to just trumpet our new plant breeding and genetics graduate and undergraduate programs. And so for those students in the audience, if you'd like to do a degree in winter hardy malting or food barley, just come see me after the symposium today. Just a word about the TCAP and what that is. I said that it does involve most of the breeding and research programs that are focused on wheat and barley in the U.S., and this is a map showing the locations of these various research programs there, and we're united with a principal thrust at looking at nitrogen use efficiency, water use efficiency, and low temperature tolerance. And the low temperature tolerance piece is one that is a little sort of a special and a unique thrust within the barley research group, sort of under the general framework of water use efficiency. In addition to this sort of extensive phenotyping, coordinated phenotyping exercise, which is analogous to what Prasanna was mentioning earlier that they're doing for heat and drought in maize, we also have a series of genotyping labs around the U.S. that are the key other components of this, in that those provide the researchers with a framework that is directed principally, or it certainly started out with the Illumina SNP platform and then is expanding into some higher density and some alternative genotyping systems as well. The thrust of the TCAP, as I said, was really on water use efficiency and nitrogen use efficiency, and coupled with the SNP platforms in barley, we're using a 9K platform. Then the goal is to implement GWAS, a genome-wide association study approach to various germplasm panels, and then that GWAS information is to plug into marker-assisted selection and genomic selection programs. So within the framework then of water use efficiency, you know, we've been working a long time in my research program on winter and facultative barleys for malt, feed, and food. That is, there's three principal uses for barley out there. And when you start talking about winter and facultative types of barleys, immediately what you come to is low temperature tolerance. And once you start invoking low temperature tolerance, there's a couple of allied traits that we need to be concerned with, and these are growth habit and flowering time. So I'm going to kind of define each one of these terms for you a bit and show you how that has led us then to where we are today with our LTT projects. So why do this sort of a shift and use fall sown cereals as a mechanism for essentially avoiding drought stress? So it's not that we're avoiding a challenging research prospect, which is drought, but we're also perhaps capitalizing on the change in precipitation patterns. And as you saw, some of those forecasts, the climate models are predicting, in fact, that we'll have less precipitation in the summer seasons, more precipitation in the winter seasons. And so if you are fortunate enough to be in an area that has a winter precipitation pattern, then why not capitalize on it? Currently, if we compare the yields of, say, a fall-sown versus a spring-sown barley in the same environment, you're going to have about a 25% yield advantage with the fall-sown cereal, assuming that it survives the winter. That's where the low-temperature tolerance piece comes into this. In areas where that fall-sown crop requires irrigation, then you're going to use considerably less water than you would if you had a spring-sown cereal at that same location. And so there's a lot of other higher-value needs for that water, be those higher-value crops, be that residential needs, or be that endangered species. There's going to be a lot of other competing demands for that water besides raising barley. In some areas, then a fall-sown cereal may also allow for double cropping. For example, on the eastern seaboard, perhaps up into the upper Midwest, you may be able to actually follow that winter cereal with a short season soybean, for example. So what are we doing with water efficiency at OSU? I just do want to point out that we didn't absolutely dodge the bullet on water use efficiency per se, and we did implement an experiment in 2012 that followed the standard protocol, if you will, for measuring water use efficiency within the TCAP project. And for that, we had 300 elite facultative and winter six-row barleys. And this array is composed of accessions out of my breeding program and Kevin Smith's program at the University of Minnesota. And we had two irrigation regimes under spring-planted conditions in the Willamette Valley. Probably if you think of the Willamette Valley of Oregon, you're thinking of very large Douglas firs and a very green environment, and you wonder how on earth can you have drought in an environment like that. Fortunately, our rains typically stop on the 4th of July, and they don't resume until the 15th of October. So our summers are actually an optimum time to look at drought, if not temperature stresses. In this experiment, we looked at a whole panel of agronomic traits. We implemented a canopy spectral reflectance device, which is one of the cornerstones of the TCAP project, and then we brought in our Illumina 9K data to weigh in on that. We weren't really that pleased with the results of that experiment, and so for the 2014 harvest, that is for planting in 2013, we now have our same panel of 300 individuals. We're out in a 250-millimeter rainfall area in Sherman County, Oregon, much more representative of dryland cereals, and here we'll be measuring agronomics in this area, plus the canopy spectral reflectance, and again, we have the same 9K data. So that's really our take on a straightforward water use efficiency approach. So what are we doing then with LTT, or low temperature tolerance per se? We've got three panels that we're using, and I'm going to go into each one of these panels in a little greater depth here and explain to you its composition. All of these have been now genotyped with the 9K. We have the first analyses already available on the World Core that was developed by the National Small Grains Germplasm Collection. This is a subset of about 370 or so accessions that were identified by Harold Bockelman and staff within the National Small Grains Germplasm Collection as having potential for being winter barleys. And one of the criteria that they use for them was the fact that they had a vernalization sensitivity. I'll talk a bit more about vernalization here in just a sec. The other criteria that they used, of course, was passport data, and if these came from locations where it tended to be cold, then they said, well, maybe that could be a winter barley. These barleys have been tested for low temperature tolerance under field conditions in Minnesota, at St. Paul, Minnesota, in collaboration with Kevin Smith. And then in the Willamette Valley of Oregon, then we've looked at phenology and quantitative disease resistance under field conditions. We really don't get low temperature tolerance events in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. If you wanted to think of a parallel climate, it might be Scotland, sort of cool and damp during the winter. Second panel that we're using is what we call the FACWIN-6, consists of 300 individuals. I alluded to this earlier. This is the panel that we had done our standard water use efficiency study on. In this case, we've got LTT data coming from field trials in Minnesota and at Utah, and in Oregon we do agronomics and nitrogen use efficiency. So on the same panel, we're doing NUE traits, again using the CSR, and in Utah, they're mirroring those same measurements. We also are interested in malting quality. That's one of the end uses of barley, and so therefore we also are looking at malt quality assessments in collaboration with the USDA lab in Madison, Wisconsin. And finally, sort of the flagship piece for this is perhaps the largest panel yet assembled for small grains for GWAS, and this is a set of 941 accessions from around the world. And what we did is we contacted everyone that I know who works on barley around the world and said, please send me your best and most winter-hardy barley varieties so that we can put a panel out that will take us beyond what we've already discovered in terms of low-temperature tolerance genes. And so we put this panel together, and the genotyping of that's recently been completed with the 9K, and that is out at 14 locations around the world this fall. So this will hopefully give us some new insights into the LTT situation. So that kind of gives you a little picture of the framework within which we're operating. So let me tell you a bit more about low temperature tolerance, facultative growth habit, and some of these other terms that I've been throwing around rather loosely here. Low temperature tolerance is a deceptively simple phenotype to measure and also to define, because it just means the ability to survive low temperatures. So that seems pretty straightforward. Physiologically, it's quite complex in that it is an acclimated sort of response. Material has to be exposed to a period of low temperatures before achieving its low temperature potential, and I'll come back to this deceptively simple phenotype a bit later in the presentation. This image is when it is simple. These are field trials at St. Paul, Minnesota, and Kevin Smith was able to walk through these plots and assign them quantitative ratings of zero survival to 100%, and you can generate a very nice quantitative scale that way at a very high heritability. So if you have a good field test environment, then you can generate some excellent data. Let's touch on a couple of other sort of key and allied traits here that are very important to this discussion. Vernalization sensitivity is the situation where a period of low temperature is required before the plant can transition from a vegetative to a reproductive growth stage. And what we see is on the left, would be on your left there, the situation where the same accession has been vernalized to the left, and so it's flowering in a normal time frame, and on your right where the same accession has not been vernalized and it just remains in a vegetative state. If you put material out in a spring planting and it doesn't receive sufficient low temperature units to vernalize, it will be entirely vegetative, as you see in the foreground, and the material in the background then is already proceeded to flower. Short day period sensitivity is a situation where at day lengths less than around 10 hours, the plant will delay the transition from the vegetative to the reproductive growth stage. So why this transition from vegetative to reproductive growth stage? Why are we so hung up about that? Because plants only acclimate and achieve low temperature tolerance at a vegetative growth stage. Once the transition to reproductive growth occurs, then you basically sort of begin to unwire the whole regulon that drives low temperature tolerance. So growth habit, this then comes back to the question of vernalization sensitivity and short day sensitivity. Spring growth habit, that is spring barley, spring wheats, this is a situation where the varieties or accessions are not vernalization sensitive, nor are they low temperature tolerant. Winter types are vernalization sensitive and they are low temperature tolerant, and facultative, a term that I promised to define, refers to accessions that are not vernalization sensitive but are short day sensitive and are low temperature tolerant. So just kind of bear that definition in mind here, because I'm going to argue that facultative growth habit is the optimum growth habit for cereals in a time of climate change. Okay? And the reason I'm arguing for this is because if you have low temperature tolerance and you do not have vernalization sensitivity and you are sensitive to short day lengths, then you have created a variety that a farmer can plant at any time. Right? Since it does not require vernalization and it's only sensitive to short days, if day length is long, then it might as well be a spring variety. What you're seeing in the foreground is a facultative winter, we thought, six row. It's actually a facultative six row called Maha, spring planted, Brownsville, Oregon. It was crop that the farmer was very pleased with, and our local malt house said that it was the prettiest winter barley crop that they'd ever seen. And I had to correct them and say, no, facultative barley crop, because you can have that fall planted or you can have it spring planted. Take your pick. That's facultative. Processors can source the same variety, be it fall planted or spring planted, and breeders can work faster. Vernalization is sort of an irritant out there because you can satisfy that in a growth chamber with about 6 weeks at 60 degrees C, but it just slows you down during that whole breeding process and really complicates your life if you're doing off-season nurseries. So the facultative growth habit, as I said, the facultative growth habit is the habit for today and tomorrow. How do you get there? How do you manage this biology? One is you need to turn off the vernalization pathway. You need to turn on short day photoperiod sensitivity. You've got to be sure that the LTT regulon, low temperature tolerance regulon, is all there. And the beauty of this is that this growth habit is independent of end use. So food, feed, malt, it doesn't matter. You can have facultatives of all sorts. Let's introduce some of the genes that are driving these traits and some of the phenomena that are involved, because it's really cool. About everything that's happening in genetics today is involved in the genetics of growth habit and low temperature tolerance. For low temperature tolerance, you have alternative functional alleles at what are known as the VernH1 and FRH1 loci. You've got chromatin remodeling operating at the same locus. You have gene deletion in the case of VernH2, and you have copy number variants in the case of VernH3 and FRH2. Short day sensitivity, SDPPD, is a situation of a loss of function allele at the PPDH2 locus. These are sort of the generic biology terms for these loci. Candidate genes are actually known for all of these. Let me just tell you real quickly about these various genes and what they do. FRH1 and FRH2 are two loci that are both located on chromosome 5H of barley, and this is some data from the recent publication in the Plant Genome showing some LTT data from Kevin's field trials. And just note the blue bar there, and that is the low temperature tolerance of accessions that have both FRH1 and FRH2. So key information that you've got to have both low temperature tolerance genes in order to get to the position that you want. Notably, a majority of the accessions shown in this germplasm group are of facultative growth habit. So the facultative growth habit is entirely separable from the degree of low temperature tolerance. FRH3 is something that we discovered fairly recently. This is out in this year's tag, and you'll note that the really big QTL effect there is actually for barley stripe rust resistance, and the lower effects are for survival at Minnesota under field conditions or in a phytotron condition with some collaborators in Hungary. So you can see the very large QTL effect that you get for field resistance to a fungal pathogen, and the still very large QTL effects that you can have under both controlled environment and field conditions. VernH3 is something that popped up fairly recently for us as a low temperature tolerance effect. We had ignored this entirely, and VernH3, otherwise known as HVFT1, is on chromosome 7H, and we picked that up in a GWAS analysis recently. So there's a couple of genes that are known to be involved in low temperature tolerance. So how do we put all these things together in the context of the genetics of a facultative solution? So with VernH1, FRH1, as I've sort of got the green and the reds there, showing we want the capacity for chromatin remodeling. So we know the genetic basis of that, and we can proceed in that direction. VernH3 is a situation where we want a particular copy number variant. So I have sort of the expanded cartoons there showing my larger section of chromatin. Same for FRH2, also a copy number variant situation there. It's a cluster of CBF transcription factors, and apparently the more of them, the better off you are. VernH2 is a key driver in all of this because you want it absent. You want Vern deletion in order to be facultative. Once you've pulled that out of the equation, then you maintain your LTT regulon intact, and you're not having to mess with the vernalization pathway. PPDH2 is actually a loss of function allele, but it's a truncated version of the gene, so it's not a complete deletion of the gene. So we've got the molecular tools then to track each one of these phenomena in our breeding and genetic studies. Let me just show you a little bit of data here coming out of the TCAP and some of the results that we've already been able to generate in terms of low temperature tolerance. This is just to show you with a PCA that the genetic diversity within the winter core subset of the total core mimics a similar distribution of genetic diversity for the 9K SNPs. These are some phenotype data from Kevin's trial in 2012. We already saw the image in the lower left. That's just showing you the histogram of the phenotypic frequency distribution there. And then this is doing a GWAS analysis of it. And so what we're finding is FRH1, FRH2. We knew about these. The denso gene is a dwarfing gene in barley, so that's kind of cool that popped up here. And then we have some various flowering time genes that are related to also to low temperature tolerance. Again, that vegetative to reproductive transition question. The deceptively simple phenotype business. This is St. Paul in 2013. Everything dies. Okay, so that's, it's very simple to measure low temperature tolerance. Everything dies. The only thing that you can check is the position of your wheat checks. That's the one surviving row that you see there. So what are we doing with the large panel? Well, here, again, we're trying to move beyond FRH1, FRH2, FRH3, sort of all the chestnuts, the sitting ducks, the fish in the barrel that we've already found, and ask the question, what else is there out there? And with a very large panel, will we have the power to find some of those smaller effect QTL? So we've got this panel, 941 accessions, and it's out at a number of locations that you can see on the map here. Again, in Oregon, we're not a low-temperature environment, so we're interested in disease resistance, phenology, morphology, seed increase, and then these other cooperators are indeed pushing the low-temperature envelope to one degree or another. So how can we implement the facultative solution? And what we've tried to put together is sort of a rapid response barley breeding program. Double haploids are a cornerstone of our effort. We heard also from Prasanna in maize that he was producing 125,000. In my dreams, I would be doing that in barley, but we're knocking out about 3,000 to 5,000 a year at this point, but that's sufficient for our own needs. Continual sowing, since you're facultative, you can be planting your material at any time of year. We've got a DNA fingerprinting for key genes. So, for example, we can work with our Pullman genotyping lab in Devon C there to be using sequenom assays for those genes that we're really keen about tracking down. We can also use the same approaches for genomic selection. And so we have a greater number of markers using the 9K or some custom SNP platforms. And we can track changes in allele frequency at the genes we know about as we move through that genomic selection process. And finally, just phenotyping. This is just an overall schematic for our doubled haploid genomic selection process for facultative malting and food barleys. And so this program is now underway. We have our training populations out in the field for the first time this year, visiting with Mark Sorrells, who's also here in the audience, and then Kevin Smith. This could be an opportunity, really, where you could have a truly national sort of a program that would allow us to share the same training population, establish our individual breeding values, design our crosses, and then redistribute this material to the cooperators. So that is underway. So where is all this headed? U.S. barley acreage has been declining in a linear fashion ever since I took my job at Oregon State University in 1986, and so I'm always comforted by the statistical notion that correlation is not causation. So I would blame this very much on a number of farm programs and other things, but we are seeing an uptick, and that's very encouraging for barley production. And look at the other graph there at your right, and that's U.S. malt imports, and so production has declined as we have imported barley from our friends to the north. So we are capable of producing excellent barleys in the United States, and so I anticipate that in the future that we will be producing barleys of all sorts of uses. Finally, just thanks to the staff at Oregon State University, and I've got a new graduate student in the audience here, Dustin Herb. I've already counted him in as number 6. That brings us up to an even 10 and sort of filled out the slide quite nicely. And special thanks to Kevin Smith at the University of Minnesota, because he works in a truly cold place and can generate the phenotype data that we need. And with that, thank you very much.
Is there a relationship between low temperature tolerance and frost tolerance?
Yes. If you look in the literature, you will see the term frost tolerance. The question was, is there a relationship between LTT, low temperature tolerance, and frost tolerance? And it's all semantic. And so I would say that they are equivalent. If you do a search in the literature, you'll find that many of our European colleagues refer to frost tolerance. That's where the FR comes from, like FRH1 and FRH2. So those were frost tolerance 1 and 2. That said, low temperature tolerance itself is a very different animal in different cold environments, because you can have a situation where you have ice adhesion. You can have a situation where you have snow cover. You can have a situation where your plant is actually desiccating under the conditions of high wind. And so you need to be able to characterize exactly when and what your low temperature stress was. But you still have that deceptively simple relationship. How many were there in the fall and how many made it through to the spring? Then you can work back through to the cause.
One more question.
Yes?
The group that you put together, it seemed as if you're working only with germplasm, which have been developed by these groups. And are you working with any land races, since you're looking at the facultative type of growth? Maybe the center of diversity might produce some varying genetic type?
Yeah, excellent question. What about the genetic diversity in these panels that we've put together, and do we have land races? Answer to that would be that in general, the large panel, the LTT panel that we have, is consists of foundational varieties and current varieties from North America and Europe. The reason for that geographic spread is that typically in the southern hemisphere, there has been a fall production of cereals, but not in low-temperature stress environments. And so Australia, New Zealand, South Africa are very large barley production areas, but not under real low-temperature stress situations. As far as moving back to more ancestral accessions, those are hopefully represented in the National Small Grains Core collection that we have for winter barleys. Brian Stephenson at the University of Minnesota has been working extensively with Hortium spontaneum, the ancestor of cultivated barley, and he's been also looking at low temperature tolerance in that material. We can never cast a wide enough net for all of our surveys, and so please, if you have some ideas on additional accessions that we could use, let's visit.